Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Xander, what are we drinking tonight?
So we are drinking a cocktail of my own design tonight. This is one I made a couple of years ago. It is called the Desert Storm. It features a rock, which, if people are unfamiliar with, is a Middle Eastern spirit generally. It is usually distilled from grapes, and this comes with Syrian anise seed as well. So this is Oregon Arak. This is from Bull Run Distilling in Portland, Oregon. So this is a local Arak. Most of it does come from the Middle East.
I have never heard of this liquor, and it is delicious.
Yes. If you are a fan of things like absinthe or possibly maybe Sambuca, you will like Arak. It is quite lovely. It's a really interesting liquor as well. When you add water or ice to it, it actually becomes cloudy. It's a clear spirit, but with water or ice, it clouds up. So the Desert Storm consists of real grenadine, which is very pomegranate-based, orange juice, and I usually put a little splash of pineapple in there as well, but there's a little snafu with the pineapple juice today, but I still think it turned out pretty well.
That's my bad. I actually scoured the grocery store looking for the perfect pineapple juice, and then I saw it, and I reached up, grabbed a canister of it, and left the store. And I must have reached up and grabbed the one next to it by accident, because what I brought home ended up not being what I thought I had grabbed. My bad.
So this says, joining forces over a shared love of anise and tradition, Mex Hamal Hassan and Bull Run Distilleries Lee Madoff created a unique spirit distilled from Willamette Valley Pinot Noir and Syrian anise seed. Oregon Arak captures and combines the spirit and terroir of the Northwest and the Middle East.
Well, that's pretty tasty. What do you think far, Jacob?
Very tasty. Arak is a liqueur I'm very I'm familiar with, and I enjoy it immensely, either on its own or in a cocktail when I go to a Lebanese establishment. The other thing I love to do with it is I use it in many different dishes for cooking.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Even down to taking a eyedropper and taking small amounts of arak as I'm making stuffed grape leaves and just putting a drop on it. As you, right before you fold the grape leaf, so you put the filling on it, you put the drop on, you fold up the grape leaf. It's amazing.
Fantastic.
So interestingly enough, I'm just looking at this bottle right here. So it is 86 proof, which is kind of nice. I guess most of the rock's actually 100. I had no idea.
Yeah.
This is batch number one.
Yep.
So this is a very new product, clearly.
Ooh.
And I like it.
So wait, you've never had this one before?
Not this particular type.
Oh, okay.
I was trying to find a Lebanese or Syrian Arak, and I couldn't find it at the liquor store. We have a liquor search thing you can use to find liquor in any liquor store in the state-run liquor stores in this state. But they also include bottles that they won't sell you because they're meant to go out to other bars that have actually already ordered them. So I went to the Pearl Specialty liquor store thinking they would have the best selection in kind of the downtown area, which they do. And it said they had six different varietals, of which only one was for sale for me. All the rest were going out to specialty bars, but they showed up in the liquor search anyways.
Well, as a podcast based here in Portland, Oregon, and by the way, you're listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars based in Portland, Oregon. We talk about the intersection of bike culture, geek culture, and bar culture. I am Nathaniel, your host, and sitting to my left,
just Jacob.
And Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And we really appreciate drinks that are bottled and distilled here, that are distilled and bottled here in Portland, Oregon. So I'm glad that you were able to get one that represents the local color.
And that's kind of the reason I was actually kind of excited about this. I'd wanted to go more traditional, and then I thought, wait, they make one here? Which is, again, obviously very new, batch number one. And I would say so far, this is quite delicious and, ironically, the cheapest one I could find as well.
Well, hey,
that didn't hurt.
Tasty and cheap. Now, that's awesome. now let's hit the road. Xander, it's good to have you back. We missed you at our last session, and again, we're glad to have you back with us at the table here.
I am very happy to be back here. I really miss the fact that I didn't get to see Christina and Mike, because I miss Christina. I've never met Mike.
Well, Christina was also very sad that you weren't here as well. Well,
we should definitely get her back in, because I really enjoyed that episode, and I remember listening to it, and so many points I shouted, I want to jump in right here.
I got something to say.
I remember my first MMO.
Since you were unable to be with us last time, I decided to put our first topic of the evening as one of the ones that you had put forward, which is bike lanes and green lanes. We had mentioned this a little bit in one of our first episodes.
Yes.
When we started setting up ideas for the Fuck Peabot episode.
Fuck Peabot.
Fuck Peabot.
This is not the Fuck Peabot episode, but I have a feeling some of the topics are going to be tangential to that.
Oh, Nathaniel, I'm doing research.
Yeah, we're planning that as a big, like a, some kind of a celebratory spectacular of how much we hate Peabot. But yes. Xander, bike lanes, green lanes. Take it away.
I think everyone out there, regardless of where you live, knows what a bike lane is.
I would hope so.
I would hope so. Yeah. If not, that's weird. And where are you living?
The country.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. But, I mean, you've probably heard of a bike lane if you live in the country, don't you?
Well, I mean, television is a thing.
Right, yeah.
Go ahead and clarify for those who don't what a bike lane is.
So a bike lane is a designated spot on a road traveled by cars, in which cars are not supposed to go and cross into because they are meant for just bicycles. They are generally just wide enough for a bicycle to pass, to go single file, not really wide enough usually for two.
And they're usually on the right side of the road.
Yep.
Well, in the States, on the right side of the road. They are on the outside of the lane, right?
Yeah.
That'd be a good way of saying it.
With some exceptions.
They're generally in the generally, yeah, there are exceptions. There are sealed bike paths.
North Williams
there
Street, are, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. Downtown Portland is a fantastic example in that there are a number of bike lanes that are on the left side. But anyway, typically they're on the right side. They are outside of the lane, essentially.
Yes. Green lanes and Portland greenways, generally speaking, in this city are either streets which are designated as, yes, a car can drive on them, but it's meant for bike thoroughfares.
Oh, I misunderstood what you were talking about. In my brain, you were talking about
the green boxes.
The green boxes.
Oh, I'm going to talk about those too.
Okay, we'll get to that then.
Yeah. So the Portland Greenways is what they're called, and they are certain streets, north, south, you know, east, west going, and they are meant predominantly for bike travel. They take away a lot of stop signs that kind of go through there, so bikes can just kind of keep on going.
Or they sometimes will have a stop, but say, like, bikes don't need to stop.
Or press this button to make the blinky light go on to indicate to cars that a bicyclist is going to come through.
Yeah.
For instance. However, like most good intentions on the road to hell, cars take them a lot, because why wouldn't you take a place that has no stop signs? That just makes sense.
Well, aren't a lot of them pre-existing roads that people live on?
Oh, absolutely. That's the thing. They're not just a bike lane. It's a regular street in the city that they have just designated as bike thoroughfares, and they took out a lot of stop signs to kind of encourage bicyclists to do them, and then car drivers go on them because there's no stop signs.
Yeah.
And aren't many of these greenways actually run through significant residential districts?
Predominantly, yes. That was the idea, was to have cyclists be able to go and bike in less trafficked areas for their safety.
So putting bike lanes, taking up pre-existing roads through neighborhoods lots of people live in, usually house-based, not apartment-based.
Yes.
Okay, I'll leave it at that.
Well, I mean, again, the road to hell, good intentions and all that, but most of the, and I take these actually to get here every week. I come here via those greenway thoroughfares, and they do have actually pretty good signage. That's the best thing I will say about the thoroughfares, is that the signage is excellent. It'll say, this is approximately how far away you are from this destination. This is how much time it will take you to get there from where you are right now, based on the average speed of a cyclist.
Yeah.
The signage is great. But again, if you want bikes to be safe and to have them take up an entire lane of traffic and cars that don't really care or still think much of cyclists, it's almost kind of inviting disaster. I have no statistics on this, but I have felt many times on these thoroughfares that you still have to kind of get out of the way for these people.
Let's just take a moment to clarify. Xander, what is your actual stance on them? Are you for them or against them?
I like the idea. I really do. But I think that if you wanted to make a city that was really bike friendly, you should probably just make areas that are just bike only. Now, you can't do that on existing streets because people have cars and they live on them.
Yeah, we've brought this up before, definitely.
So what would I do in my ideal world? Maybe make a separate system of transit for bicycles just to use. I mean, they do that in, going back to bike lanes, in many cities in Canada that I've gone to, they've taken existing streets, but they've also gone and made a concrete barrier that separates cars from bikes. And so there's no conflict there. And you can't, as a car, go and accidentally merge into the bike lane because there are physical concrete barriers that prevent you from doing that.
That's like the Amsterdam model with the anchor chain post that protect the bike lanes from the cars.
Well, so I've been to Amsterdam. It was a while ago.
Yes.
2008. Things might have changed.
So a decade. These are crazy modern times, Xander. We don't know what's changing.
What I saw in Amsterdam when I was there was that cars could basically go and fuck themselves and,
yes,
and go and sit and stall as 1,000 bikes went by.
Yes.
As they were normal commuters. And basically, if you were a car, you just knew that you had to sit there and wait for every bike to go by, and you had to sit there and kind of take it between the streetcars that were going through and the pedestrians and the cyclists. It just seemed like, why would you own a car in that city? Mm-hmm. At least in the core of the city, they had transport ships, mm-hmm, that were just meant for bicycles.
I'm just picturing space transports.
But these things were three levels of just ferries that would ferry across bicycles to different parts of Amsterdam. It was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen. Well, I mean, we are familiar in the Northwest with the Washington State ferry system, yes?
Mm-hmm. I'm not.
Okay.
So, I use it all the time.
So Washington State, just north of us, they have a state-run ferry system that ferries across people and cars because the Puget Sound is a massive amount of random islands everywhere and people need to get around there.
So this is up in Seattle?
Seattle area, yes.
Okay, gotcha.
But also includes the Willamette.
Wait, what? There's ferries?
Not immediately adjacent to Portland, but yes.
Okay. Wait, no. All right. Refresh my knowledge here. Doesn't the Willamette begin at the split where it comes off the Columbia?
Yes. No. You're right.
It's way south of here.
Sorry. Doesn't it end where it meets the Columbia?
Yes.
Okay. So never mind. How can Washington cross the Willamette?
Okay. I said the Willamette. Okay. I should have said the Columbia. You're correct.
Yes. That makes more sense.
That makes more sense.
Okay.
Thank you.
But anyways, Amsterdam had this whole transport system of ferries that was just for bicycles.
Okay.
Not for cars. A three-level ferry for just bicycles. So there are models out there in the world that are infinitely superior to Portland if you want to make a bike-friendly city.
Such as
Amsterdam. Also... Portland and Minneapolis, St. Paul frequently fight for the best bike city in the United States. But if you want to look internationally, from the cities that I've been to personally, cities such as Vancouver, BC, Montreal, in Quebec, as well as, Amsterdam, all of those areas had, to me, infinitely better bike infrastructure than the city does. The city still tries to straddle allowing cars and bikes to have some kind of safe space while achieving not really either one.
Uh-huh. What do you think then about the events that we have here?
Pedalpalooza?
No, the... come on.
Critical Mass?
No.
World Naked Bike Ride?
It's like...
I've already told you what I thought about that.
There's four of them a year. Sunday Parkways.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I love them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the Sunday Parkway is a similar temporary version of a green lane that turns a significantly larger number of not even bike greenways into temporary greenways.
So for those of you who are not familiar with Sunday Parkways here in Portland, Oregon, what that is every quadrant of our city, which is divided into north, northeast, northwest, southwest, and southeast, they have a city-sponsored event in which they will just completely cordon off vast stretches of road and a specific route that is just for bicycles. And these are not normal greenways.
And pedestrians. Skateboards and roller skates and all that.
Things that are not cars.
Yeah. Yes.
And
non-motorized transportation.
Yes.
Including non-motorized transportation such as indoor, outdoor carpeting and couches. Because like Belmont is known for the fact they usually turn one lane into outdoor living rooms.
Wait, but, during the Sunday Parkway?
Yeah, during the Sunday Parkway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They just set up little hangout areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All on the street.
Yep.
But it's kind of the idea of going and bringing the concept of a city square back to a city in a way in which that the traditional city square was just meant for pedestrians and cyclists and public transit, basically. Or mass transit, I guess, is a better way to say it. Because traditionally, or at least in this city, the light rail was run by private companies and there were a bunch of competing lines. Which is a fun history in and of itself, which we'll talk at another episode.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the green boxes, Andrew? Let's talk about those.
Green boxes are vastly confusing pieces of, again, a good intention gone awry. So at intersections, if you're in the, if it's a one-way street usually, and you're in the right lane, they will have it so you can't come up to the actual intersection itself because there is a giant green painted area in which a vehicle, a car, is not supposed to enter. And it's very, it doesn't make sense from a car perspective or much from a cyclist perspective, but it's meant to prevent people who are then making, say, right-hand turns from crossing over into a cyclist. But there's no real, there was no, never a big campaign to ever educate anybody as to what the fuck these things were.
Dear listener, let me describe how these look. So our downtown area is a number of two-lane, one-way streets. And in those streets, you will occasionally have, at an intersection, two lanes that come up to the stoplight, to the crosswalk. The rightmost lane, the last 10 feet of it or so, right before the crosswalk, is painted green with a white outline around it.
Of a cyclist.
Of a cyclist. But there's no sign that says anything about what it's supposed to do. And there was never any kind of major public education that went into it.
No. Nope.
One day, they were just there.
Yep.
And there are laws now against being in them in a car or turning across them in a car.
Or a motorcycle.
Or a motorcycle that no one has been educated about, but everyone is expected to know. They're a little funky.
They're funky. They're not intuitive at all. And let's face it, downtown is full of a crap ton of tourists. So if you're in Portland, you might kind of understand what they're about. I still don't think most people do. But if you're a tourist, you have clearly never seen one of these things in your life.
And let's not forget that in the downtown area, there are several streets where for a block or more, they have converted full car size lanes into green boxes.
Oh, yeah. There's my office is on Second. And half of Second is now extra parking that was moved out and then made wider. And then it was put into this huge bike lane on the left side of the street for some reason that cars now have to turn left across and no one's used to doing it. So everyone's very confused. And they have these big green lanes. Nobody knows what to do. So there's constantly collisions.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is the biggest issue is that you have these ideas that are coming out of City Hall and fuck Peabot. And they have these ideas that they think are great, but they can only be a halfway decent idea if you tell people about them, but they have no mechanism to actually go and inform the public. They're not going and sending mailers. They're not going and having any kind of great way to have any information put out to anybody about these things. They just show up one day.
The irony of that is that all that they really do is try to raise awareness because they don't make change. Change doesn't give them money. What gives them money is developers who have no reason to support bike infrastructure. So what they do is they make this illusion of change, but all it does is shift the bike lane from the right side to the left side for some reason, paint a green thing in the road, but then, despite them wanting to raise awareness, they don't actually make anyone aware of it. Thanks, PBot. Fuck
well,
you.
Well, maybe if you were more woke.
Oh. Okay, first of all, the whole developer argument, I'll take exception at. The fact is that many developers in this town use the bicycle infrastructure as an excuse to build multi-unit buildings
that don't have
with parking.
But they can charge you more money for them.
No, Jacob. They're still totally paying for the fact that they don't want the bike lanes. What they want is a status quo.
Right.
And you may take exception to that. What they call bike friendly is just marketing.
Exactly.
It has nothing to do with their actual grand strategy. It's just an excuse for not having. What they call bike friendly, they don't even clear with the city. They just put it on. It's like vitamins.
Oh, no,
you can
no.
call something healthy that doesn't even healthy on its packaging. Just like you can call something bike friendly
just
because it doesn't have parking.
Any
just,
of those.
Grr!
Give me just a minute. I live half a block off of Clinton, which is one of the worst designed green routes in this
yes,
entire city.
It is.
I live a block and a half off Division, where they've used the excuse of we're a bike-friendly city with great bike infrastructure with the shitstorm Clinton half a block away to put up all of these multi-unit developments with no parking and not enough bike lockups for one bike per unit in the building.
Numbers of them don't even have elevators. They just have really wide stairways that are bike friendly to carry your bike.
Six stories tall. Yep. Have fun with that one, kids. Well, and here's the other thing. Have you ever seen one of these new complexes that goes and advertises itself as being super bike friendly, welcome to Portland, green eco environment, with any good bike infrastructure around it?
No.
Yeah, there's one or two.
One or two of the...
Like, along Lincoln, there's a couple, and
okay, so we're getting
Williams,
pretty far south.
I mean, that's it. There's not
that's
many.
That's about it, though.
That's it.
That's about it. And there's a lot of new development in this city. A lot.
Yeah.
So I think we can pretty much agree that it's all kind of a ploy and a marketing
scam.
It's a scam.
I just want to close this out because we've kind of gone a little bit long here by once again saying, fuck PBot.
Fuck PBot. And I got one thing I got to throw in right. there.
Let's make that trend. Hashtag fuck PBot.
Yep.
You heard it here first. Hashtag fuck PBot. Let us at Bikers Dice and Bars know that you're listening with hashtag fuck PBot. That's FUCKPBOT.
Before we get out of this section, I got to talk about green boxes because I have really strong opinions about them. As we've mentioned, motorcycles are not allowed to use green boxes. They don't count as a bicycle by state, city ordinance. They are not allowed to pull into the green box. That means motorcycles are sitting 10 feet back from frequently obscured intersections. Then in order to make a turn, have to cross the green box, sometimes in front of traffic. And we've ended up with more than once cars turning onto streets that have green boxes or motorcyclists turning off of streets that have green boxes and getting killed. That also happens to bicyclists, but it happens more often to motorcyclists.
Well, it's also been proven that they have not done what they're supposed to do. So what have we done?
Keep it up! What were they supposed to do? Nobody told me.
They're supposed to make cyclists safer, but because of the confusion with people in motor vehicles, cars, trucks, because of that confusion, no one knows what they're there for and they don't abide by them. But cyclists are trying to because they more understand what they're for than car drivers are. And so if one person understands what the game is and the other person doesn't, and the one who doesn't is in a giant vehicle that can kill you by making a mistake, cyclists are going to lose every time.
Cyclists are going to lose every time. That's how it ultimately is here in Portland, which advertises itself as the most bike-friendly city in the United States.
Hashtag fuck PBot.
Now let's bring this to the table. Once again, Xander, it's good to have you back. This is another one of your topics that I know that you and probably all of us have strong opinions about, and that is
loot crates.
Or I hate it already.
Or I skin crawled.
Now, Ed, listener, to clarify, we're not talking about looting crate dragons as we talked about in the last episode. We're talking about literal crates of loot in video games. Xander, tell us a little bit more about them.
So the general premise of a loot crate is they're mostly found in very kind of big box, huge electronic art games. Ubisoft has a number of them, but they are generally larger releases in which, in order to progress your character further, the easiest way to do that is to go and purchase these loot crates, which will give you random, very randomized upgrades, potential new weapons, potential characters you can unlock, potential armor. They have skins. Like, skins is a huge thing in video games now that I do not understand. But it is content which is not integral to the story of the game whatsoever, but it is very much on just the visual aesthetics or the better weaponry, et cetera, et cetera. And so there has been a lot of controversy as of late as, is this online gambling?
What do you think?
I'll go over breaking news here on Bikers, Dice, and Bars. So I've been researching this topic for a while, and I looked it up again today. And apparently the nation of Belgium in the European Union has ruled that, yes, this is in fact gambling.
Wow.
As of a few hours ago.
That has huge implications for the EU as a whole.
It does. Because the only other country in the EU to have ruled otherwise is the UK, who is about to no longer be in the EU, so they don't matter. And the basic premise is that, okay, so I wrote down a couple of things here. So what constitutes gambling in the legal definition, and this is mostly for the states, consideration, which is that you are paying to play something. So in this regard, you are paying to play to see what's in a loot crate. Chance, which is something that is outside of your control as to what the eventual outcome will become. And of course, a prize, which is, what do you win and is it something of value?
Well, how would that compare to something such as the loot crate service, which has absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the concept of the loot crates in video games? Instead, it is a subscription service where you get random shit that you may or may not like delivered to you.
I have heard of this service. I have not used it myself. Has anyone here used it?
I have not used it myself yet. I am in process of subscribing to one. I have many friends who do. One of the important distinctions to make between mail order loot crates and video game loot crates is there's usually a disclaimer in most mail order loot crates that there is a minimum value of the products that are going to show up into it that is roughly what you're paying per month.
Okay.
So say the value of the subscription-based physical loot crate is, you know, it's $20 a month. You'll get at least $20, if not more. Sure, that's fair. And so the interesting distinction so far legally within the United States of loot crates is that U.S. courts have ruled that what you get out of loot crates have no value, in which some of the lawyers have said that's because our judges are largely technologically ignorant.
Well, we don't do science-based legislation in this country. So,
and the UK courts, that's the United Kingdom, have ruled that it's not gambling because the things in which you could potentially win only have value within the game itself. So once you log off, it has no value anymore.
Okay.
But the article that I was reading from The Verge, go and give the author a shout out here because this article is actually quite excellent.
And we'll have a link to that in our show notes.
This is by Catherine Cross. She wrote this at the end of last year. But Catherine Cross had an amazing article about loot crates and kind of how it's the biggest controversy currently in gaming right now because of the legal ramifications of it and everything else kind of swirling around. But having Belgium be, I think, the first nation to actually rule against this concept of microtransactions, in which you are basically rolling the dice to see what you get out of a random crate. Now, most games have the ability to win loot crates just by completing certain weekly missions or just playing the game a lot. But basically, if you have a crap ton of money or if you are maybe a gambling addict, you will go and throw tons of money at this to get the best possible items, heroes, weapons, etc. In fact, there were several articles that I saw from people that actually used to work at EA that said, yes, I have seen people throw as much as $15,000 away in microtransactions buying loot crates.
I have two questions for you on this. First off, in some cases, like, shall we say, Star Wars Battlefront, loot crates are a direct cash purchase.
Yes.
However, there are a whole host of games where the loot crate equivalent is purchased via in-game currency that you have the option of buying the in-game currency. What is your thoughts on that once removed situation where I can take real dollars, buy in-game currency, and then choose to spend in-game currency on loot crates? Does that change the dynamic in your mind?
Not if the game has both. I think that if the game has both, it is still encouraging you. It is knowing and playing off of human psychology, knowing that you will go and spend the money to buy 50 loot crates as opposed to grinding for an hour to maybe get one.
I'd like to make a point of distinction here in that we might be drifting into two similar yet not completely congruent topics. There are the concept of microtransactions, and then there's loot crates. Now, microtransactions mean pay us X little tiny little bits of money in order to make a thing happen in the game. Mm-hmm. So here's the game. You can play the game, but you can also pay us $5 to play the game better, that kind of stuff. But loot crates are something else where you're in the game. Suddenly the game just gives you a thing and says, here, have this thing. And you're like, oh, cool. What does this thing do? Oh, we can't tell you what it does unless you pay us extra money. Suddenly, that creates an appeal. Mm-hmm. It is the game essentially selling itself to you in a somewhat shady way.
And I understand your basic argument there.
Or imagine if you were playing a game like Baldur's Gate, mm-hmm. or you were playing something, you know, a classic single-player role-playing game. You're moving through the game. I have survived a horde of monsters to go down this passageway. At the end of it is a chest. I move up to the chest. I click on the chest. And a message pops up saying, you can't open this chest unless you pay us $5. Like, you don't know what's in that chest. But the game wants you to pay it $5 to open it up. And right. It's random.
Right. And that actually, so to reframe it for you, what if you walked up to that chest and it's Baldur's Gate, and when you click on the chest, it says, you can't open this chest unless you pay us 5 platinum pieces, which very few monsters in the game drop, and never in the amount where you're ever going to get a significant number of these chests, but you can pay them $10 real money to get 100 platinum pieces.
It's the same still, thing. It's still the same thing.
Right.
You can pay us $5, or you can pay us with 300 hours of grinding.
So, and I bring this up.
And that's really what it is. It's 300 hours of your life.
Yeah.
Right. And I bring this up for very specifically because while the big AAA game companies, EA, Ubisoft, a couple others, are doing the blatant cash grab loot crate system of give us this much money, we will give you a loot crate, there is a whole host of games that are blending microtransactions for in-game currencies and then using in-game currencies to buy loot crate equivalent items, in part because they're forecasting that loot crates are probably going to get hammered by at least the EU, possibly Japan, and if they can muddy the waters enough where it becomes this mixed situation, they continue microtransactions for loot crates and end up with the same result, but in a more cloudy legal scenario.
Using in-game currency to buy these things has been a thing for a while. I've played a number of MMOs that do it, that have been doing it for some time. Uh-huh. Guild Wars 2 is one that comes to mind that I was really into. And in Guild Wars 2, you would find these chests that you couldn't open unless you had these special keys. Now, you could just buy the keys, but you could also randomly find the keys. They were random. That was it. But you could also gain, like, special currency. Lord of the Rings Online did something like that,
Borderlands too. Borderlands 2 had a similar thing as well, where there were certain keys you could just kind of...
They were called quick codes or flash. They had a catchy name, but they were codes.
Yeah, but you could still get them.
You could still get them.
And it wasn't
But it was massive... still bullshit. It was bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, Borderlands 2, the way they did it, made me not play that game anymore.
That upset me.
Yeah. Well, you either had to grind for 300 hours to get a good item, or you could just buy one. And it was like, what? No, this is pay to win. You want me to pay you money so I can play the game that I've already paid you to play by myself offline.
Right.
What's up with that?
Now, Xander, you've done a fair amount of research on it. Recently, didn't one of the big AAA games state they were taking loot crates out of one of their major titles?
That was EA taking Star Wars Battlefront 2, temporarily taking them out.
It was only temporary, though. Right?
Yeah, and that's actually why they were exempt from this ruling in Belgium, was that it was temporarily halted. So you can't arrest me for murder. I've decided to stop killing people for a little bit. Is basically the equivalent of what they did. But
I'm not doing it right now.
Now that you're looking at me, nope. My hands are clean. Definitely washed that blood off a little bit ago. But
did you murder somebody? Well, I'm not murdering someone. No.
That's what EA has done with Star Wars Battlefront 2. They have promised it will come back. But having played Star Wars Battlefront 2, because I got downloaded the free trial of it, and I'm thinking, this is fun. I'm going to be a stormtrooper. I'm going to shoot some people with my laser gun. And then all of a sudden, Yoda comes out of fucking nowhere and murders everybody. And Yoda is a character you get from buying loot crates. You buy enough of them, you get Yoda, you get Han Solo, you get one of these major Star Wars characters that just mass murders everybody in the game.
And that's what we call pay to win.
Yes. And so it's a combination of the two. It's you are paying for these loot crates, and you get to pay to win the game. And every single match I've ever played of that game, and I played maybe 2 or 3 hours of it before I said, fuck this, is every top-ranked player was one of these special heroes you can only obtain through loot crates. And I thought, well, I'm just kind of done with this.
So, NPC here, I'm going to break out my old pre-millennial old man rant.
Whatever, youngin.
When I was playing video games in my youth,
when I was your age,
you bought the game and you played it and it was fun and there were no expansions. But then when I got into my tweens and teens years, games started having expansion packs, but it was still really cool.
It was new content.
The idea was you have the game that you really like, and then here's a little bit more that you can add to it for a fraction of the cost of the original game. It added more to the game you already liked. That was it. It was great. It was wonderful.
Expansion packs were a really cool
Expansion packs were really fun. But at around the same time, I remember there were mini games that had unlockables. These were things in the game that you could unlock by getting certain scores or by doing certain things that were really cool. You could get different characters to play. You could get different levels to play on. You could unlock a cool weapon to use later.
But it was skill-based.
It was skill-based or simply time-based, but it was something that you could get. But it was always something that if you did something in a certain way, you'd get it.
You didn't have to pay more. You just had to be really good at the game.
That
right?
got replaced with achievements. Achievements are these meaningless bragging tags that you add. They mean nothing. They add nothing to your experience.
You have now killed 500 enemies. Here's a bring.
They are simply the developers saying, hey, if you play this in a certain way, I'm going to give you these meaningless points. Mm-hmm. And you can put them on your gamer tag or something. And they don't mean anything.
Yeah.
To some people, they like to say that, oh, it just gives you a new way to play the game. It inspires you to try something new. Well, whatever. I want to play the game the way I wanted to play it.
Right.
But achievements took away the unlockables. You don't really see them as much anymore. Instead, you have achievements and you have microtransactions. Instead of unlocking the cool content by playing really awesomely or by doing whatever, you just finish the level, get an achievement, pay us $5 more, and we'll give you a new character. And that has led to loot crates.
Loot crates.
Which so, now, you don't even pay $5 to get a cool character. You pay $5 to get a 5% chance at a cool character. Fuck you, EA. Fuck you.
So Ubisoft has just, they just admitted last year that they make more money off of loot crates than they do on selling their games.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ubisoft games are essentially the same formula repeated over and over again. They just copy-paste the entire previous game, rewrite some of the names, and there you go. There you have the Ubisoft game of the year. That doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me at all.
So the main issue that has been coming up with, at least on the legalistic side of all of this, when you have 10, 12, 14-year-olds who, you know, they're parents might have given them the credit card information to go and buy the game. And then they get the psychological hook to like gamble, want new thing.
And it's that just one more level, just one more fight.
No, exactly. And so this is where it's come under this legal scrutiny of this is basically teaching young children the bad habits of just mass gambling.
Agreed.
You've made a really good case for where the legal ground is and what the factors are. What's your actual opinion, Xander, about loot crates?
So I can give you a little bit of a... So I've my guilty pleasure right now is playing Battlefield 1.
You're one of those.
No, it's only because I find the aesthetics of World War One awesome.
Okay.
And I find the history and the subject matter fascinating, and this is the only way to really kind of have a visual of it. They'll give you the missions, and you can kind of go and struggle through the loot crate thing, and you can win them by playing certain things, and it is a slog, and obviously, but when you start the game, it's like, here's this option to pay $30 more for this game that you have paid $60 for already, and you can just unlock a shit ton of fuck-awesome weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be level one, be paired with a bunch of other crappy players, and just blow them the fuck away because you have this awesome equipment.
Right.
And to me, by and large, as a person who has loved computer games since I was a wee child, I just fundamentally believe that you should play a game based on your merit as a skillful player, as someone who has studied the aspects of the game itself. I was a big fan of RTSs when they first came out, and I studied the strategy. I read the guides. I wanted to be a good player.
Ever want to play an RTS against somebody who paid $20 extra to get a +10 on all their attacks forever.
Which is like, basically what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so to be at such a disadvantage from basically being either too poor or too smart to not pay a shit ton of money for this stuff just seems fundamentally unfair to the world of gaming in and of itself, especially because, let's face it, like when I was young, I couldn't afford a lot of games. I could maybe buy, you know, one or two, and I had to play them a lot, but I played them online. I played them competitively, Command and Conquer, old school.
Oh, yeah.
Love that game. But I played the hell out of that game, and I had to be really, 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 really good in order to actually win these games. And I saved up my allowance for these games. That's all I could afford. And then if I knew that I lost every single fucking time because some rich twat somewhere else in this country was able to do that because they just had more money than me and that my skill meant nothing, just that would have ruined computer gaming for me at age 10.
Xander, we're going to close this out because we're running a little bit high on time here. Do you have any final thoughts on it? Any last things you want to say?
So just to kind of give an analogy for those who may not be in the know about these types of games in general, it would basically be like if you had a football match, an American football match where you had, say, the Cleveland Browns, a crappy team with low revenue, and you said you get the basic gear, you get leather helmets, you get some shin pads, and that's about all you get. And then you take a high revenue team, such as the New England Patriots, and they get spiked armor. They get the most awesome helmets, and they also get weapons. And you say, go and play football now. Hike. That is the equivalent of what we are talking about. It is a massively unfair playing field for people that are just don't have the money to do this. Because it doesn't matter how good of a player you are. If your opponent has infinitely better weaponry and armor and gear than you possibly have, you cannot possibly play on a level playing field based upon your skill alone. And that is why I think we can all agree, fuck loot crates.
Yeah, I'm not into loot crates. I'm not into pay to win. And I think all of it kind of tarnishes the games that I sit down to play for a leisurely activity. Jacob, any last words?
You know, as someone who doesn't play a lot of modern video games, I am mostly unaffected by loot crates. And my general take of it is it's an exploitive revenue stream. If it wasn't for the fact that it's aimed almost exclusively at miners.
Yes.
Let me rephrase that, because it's not almost exclusively. In fact, it's actually heavily weighted towards people in their early 20s. But given that a fair amount of it is aimed at miners, that creates some challenges. And I mean, I'm not in favor of loot crates. I would avoid games that have loot crates. But at the same time, you know, it'd be one thing if they were like publishing the odds.
even slot machines tell you the odds.
Right. Loot crates don't. I know. I play one game that does have a play-to-win component. I don't engage in that. I'm a grinder, and people think I'm stupid for it, but I enjoy it. But one of the biggest things is whenever one of the big pay-to-win events comes out is people are reporting within the guilds how many crates they had to open to get the special something or other, because it's never published.
And on that note, let's go ahead and close this out. And now let's take it to the bar. Well, we've been drinking this drink for some time now, and I must say, I love this, Sander.
Thank you.
I don't even remember what's in it. I remember it was a rock.
A-R-A-K, if you're interested in trying to find the liquor yourself. It is predominantly a Middle Eastern liquor. It is usually distilled from grapes, and it is usually mixed with anise seed as well.
This is delicious. I really dig this.
And to be honest, if you ever go to a Lebanese restaurant or Middle Eastern restaurant and you see Arak on the menu, order a glass of it or a cocktail that has it in it with your meal, and it really changes your experience of the food.
So this particular drink we are drinking tonight, again, is, I call it the Desert Storm. It is mixed with orange juice, usually a splash of pine, but there is a mishap with that, and some authentic pomegranate grenadine as well.
So let's bring this to the topic of the evening for the bar segment, which is something that, again, Xander had put on the list, but I think all of us have something to say about it.
Yeah,
and that
do.
Is when a good dive bar bites the dust.
So I think we've all experienced that place that we just never thought at any point ever would just go away.
Yep.
It had been there before we were able to start drinking. It was there when we first turned 21. It was there for us when we first started to actually drink. And you just thought, this place is going to be here forever. This is my home. This is my comfort zone. This is where I go. This is my spot. And then one day, you read that article that says, this place is no more. Or the bartender tells you, we're done next week. Or you see the sign on the door for lease.
It's awful. Yeah.
And you just know that one place that you thought you could always go to whenever you were having the worst and most shitty day of your life, that one place that you knew that you could just go and just be wrapped up in the cheap swill and the characters and the random shenanigans you would always see there, all of a sudden just evaporates into smoke.
It's happened to all of us.
I think we've all had that place.
Yeah, and it's depressing when it does, because like we established in an earlier episode, part of the joy of a dive bar is that everybody knows each other.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the joy of going to a dive bar is that you know everybody who's there, and they know you. It is a comfortable experience. It is a second, third, if not fourth home, depending upon how you structure your life. It's a good place to relax. It's where you go when you're stressed out. It's where you go when I just had a day, and I need a drink. And I want to hang out with my buds chances are they're not even going to say anything because they all know that expression on my face.
Yep.
And you know theirs.
Uh-huh.
And when they're gone, it's really depressing.
I think the other really major thing about when a good dive bar goes down is it is literally the death of a part of the culture of a city or a town or anything like that. Because I always judge any new town I go to when I'm traveling, I judge the character of a town by its local dive. And when we live here in Portland, we have seen those just crucial pieces of the heart of this city just wilt away when a good dive ceases to exist. It's like a part of all of us dies. It is a place where we knew that beautifully melancholy familiarity just disappear.
How familiar are both of you with the history of bars in Portland?
Give us a lesson.
I'm going to save that for a future segment, but under the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, there's been a whole bunch of changes over the years. At one time, in bars in Portland, you had to bring in your own hard liquor, and they would store it for you at the bar.
Bottle clubs,
except... Yeah.
There's still a few places like
there's
that.
There's still a few, but every bar...
rich people.
Every bar that was a public house was a de facto bottle club for a while in Portland.
Also, even still today, according to the OLCC, you can still technically bring your own fifth of liquor into any bar. You just have to relinquish it to the bartender, and they have to be the one to serve it to you. They also have the option of selling it back to you at a price of their choosing. But if I wanted to go into my favorite bar and just say, here's my bottle of whiskey, please pour it for me, they can tell me no.
Yep.
Or they can just do it.
Wait, so you can actually bring in your own liquor to a bar?
As long as it's sealed when it comes through the door.
Oh, all right.
No one really does that. It's just an option.
It does happen at a few... So here's the weird thing. We're getting way off topic here. And I think we're going to do a segment on the history of Portland bars and Portland's rules on, because it goes into the history of the fact that Portland's actually a really corrupt town.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we'll hold on that. But
oh, will we now?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We're
going to add this to the list.
Well, we're going to add this to the list.
All right.
But we're going back
Portland to corruption.
We're going back
to
the point of when a good dive bar bites the dust. And to be honest, I moved here 2007. I've watched a lot of bars that were good, classic neighborhood drinking establishments die at the hands of Portland development.
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. The worst is when one dies at the hands of Portland development and closes down, and then the building remains and no one does shit with it. But the bar's not there, but you can pass it.
Right.
Chopsticks 2, I'm looking at you.
Oh, yeah.
I loved that place. Well, and, you know, the new place is actually pretty cool. But the old place has a special place in my heart.
Yes.
And it's still there. Right.
I've gone there for your birthday karaoke things before. And I will only say the only good thing about Chopsticks 2 is that you know that there's some rich fuck in, was it Burnside 23? I think that's what it's called.
Whatever.
But that new condo development or really high-end apartment development where that Chopsticks 2 sign is right in front of their window. They can see nothing else but what they fucked up in by their existence. And that is the only thing that gives me solace about that place no longer existing.
So I would like to bring this back to something we talked about previously, which is the Hungry Tiger. Mm. Now, you claim the Hungry Tiger is a dive bar. I went there a couple weeks ago. It's not a dive bar. That place is hip as fuck.
All right.
And that place is...
Really?
It's clearly a place that wants to be a dive bar, but it has established over several years a hipster clientele that keep coming back. That place is hip as fuck. It has dive bar veneer, but it's like somebody took a hipster location.
Go
like a couple of weeks ago.
No, I mean, what day of the week though?
Like a Tuesday,
huh?
Yeah, that's when you go to a bar.
Yeah,
a dive bar. You go on a weeknight. It wasn't divey at all. Like everybody there was fashionable, and the place was just young. It was not divey. Now the Hungry Tiger won the original. the original place that was on 28th and Burnside, where there's now just like a big multi-use development across the street from Holman's. That place, like, you walked into that place and you felt like Roach was going to fall off the ceiling into your drink. And it was wonderful. And the Chinese restaurant attached to it, the Hungry Tiger, the actual restaurant side, you didn't eat there. No, that was not a gastropub, which is what the Hungry Tiger basically is now.
Okay. So I'm going to propose something here because we have a difference of opinion. Xander firmly is of the camp. Although I'm gathering by your facial expression that you're willing to revisit the issue, that the Hungry Tiger constitutes a dive bar.
I will concede there are some douchey hipsters that go there.
Okay.
I will also say, though, that usually when I go there, which is usually after work at about 1 o'clock in the morning, that it is predominantly a bunch of just like filthy punk rock kids. And very much just full of just like just dirty rockers. It is not a hipster place. It is full of people that just want to play a game of pinball, look at the paintings of half nude women surrounded by velvet tigers, and go and get a really stiff drink.
And you're of the opinion that Hungry Tiger is not a dive bar.
Not at all.
So I am going to propose there's only one way to sort this out.
Field trip.
Sure.
Let's do this.
Why were you at the Hungry Tiger, which is two blocks from where I live, and you didn't invite me?
I always forget that you moved.
I live 3 blocks away.
I know,
from that
but
place.
For a long time, you used to live on 15th, and that's where when I pass by it, I'm like, oh, Xander's house around the corner of that apartment that you had where we played poker.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, good times.
Those were good times.
But I'm down. I stopped at the Hungry Tiger to have a nice, delicious, free-range vegan meal. So, yeah, at a dive bar. Just saying. Just like, Portland.
Portland. I have had all of one of experience at the Hungry Tiger Empire. And that was at the Hungry Tiger 2 when it was still the Hungry Tiger 2. And it was a beer and some nachos that, oh my God, there's a reason I never went back. That said, I think this is a field trip because we are on something of a quest.
No. We're going to quest to go to dive bars. We veered way off topic. There's lots of better dive bars that we can go to. Let's bring it back to dead bars. Dive bars that are no longer with us. Hungry Tiger 1 is one that I will give a shout out to. Xander, do you have any?
What did you think of the Matador?
I never went to the Matador.
Oh, okay.
I heard it was a pretty awesome punk rock place, but I never went.
The Matador was a great spot. The Conquistador is the other spot that those people own, which is still around on 21st and Belmont or so.
Wait. The
Conquistador.
Oh, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, keep going.
Yeah, but the Matador was, yeah. People who might have recently moved to Portland might understand that West Burnside used to be a shithole, and it was great. And it was full of a bunch of awesome dive bars, such as the Matador. And it was just where a bunch of just cheapskates would go to get super stiff drinks. They used to have a mystery shot, which was $1, and it was a it was a fifth of liquor that was just like covered in a bunch of question marks. And it was, this is $1 if you want a shot out of this bottle.
So what happened to the Matador?
The rent got raised too high. And they had to shut down.
That's what kills a lot of the bars in this town.
Jacob?
Let's see. Which one? Yeah. So one of my favorites, there was a bar in Old Town. And for the life of me, I don't remember the name. Partially because they didn't have a sign that they was lit.
Damn right. That's how you do it.
Science causes electricity. Come on.
And I would wander in there roughly 9:30 to 10:30 at night. I'd be one of three people in there. I'd have a nice beer. That building is now a multi-use commercial building. They had to close down because the property owner was redeveloping.
I'd like to give a shout out to a few places. The original Hung Far Low.
Oh,
one
yes.
Of the first Hung Far Low Cock.
Yeah, one of the first bars that I went to here in Portland when I moved. And it didn't last much longer after I moved here. At that place, the sign is still hanging there in downtown Portland for a location that's no longer there.
So they actually removed the sign. What? They put back a remake of the sign. It's not the original sign.
Okay. So to be fair, I haven't actually walked past that zone in a while, but the last time I drove past it real quick, it looked like the same sign.
Yeah.
It's a facsimile?
It's a facsimile.
Yes. That is frustrating.
I was still working in an old town when they mounted that.
So for those of you who might not know the story of this, Hung Far Lo was a cocktail bar, obviously, in Chinatown of the city.
They had the strongest, cheapest happy hour drinks in downtown at the time.
And so it said Fung Har Lo.
Hung Far Lo.
Hung Far Lo. And then it said cocktails, except that the tails part of the neon sign burnt out. So what it actually said was Hung Far Lo Cock, which, again, to an English-speaking audience, is hilarious. And so everyone just told them, don't ever fix the sign. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
But then the actual bar itself, I think, moved out to 82nd, I want to say.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's out on 82nd, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's just a shitty Chinese place, and their food will... No. You do not eat the food at the Hung Far Lo.
Yeah.
Used to be actually okay. No.
But there was actually a petition to get the sign put back, but obviously the cock part is no longer just the cock part. I think it actually says cocktails. But it was a beloved sign, internationally recognized and loved.
Another shout out I want to give is, it's an odd choice, but it's also a Portland icon because it's only half of a dive bar, and that the original Taco House.
Oh.
January 2018, they closed their doors. Suddenly, without informing their employees, they just closed all their locations.
Yeah.
Gone.
Oh. Yeah.
And, you know, say what you will about the quality of their food, the bars, each of their locations had a cantina side.
Yes.
That was sketchy as fuck. And I loved it because it was a great place to go and have a conversation. And in the middle of the conversation, just look around at the weird ass fuckers around you who were either getting in fights over the Oregon lottery machines, screaming at the bartender, or actually assaulting them and having to be dragged out by the entire combined force of the wait staff. Bless their hearts.
I drank on the one on 82nd a couple times. And there was something I really appreciated about being back in a bar where I got what was called a margarita, but was so strong, it did not pass muster in this town as a margarita, watching open-air meth deals going on down the bar from me.
As you do.
I want to give another shout-out to Dino's Inn.
Oh, I've only heard about Dino's.
Dino's was on Hawthorne, and just before you get to the Burgerville, really close in. And Dino's was this tiny little slice of a strip club, and it was wonderful. It was, again, it was a straight-up dive. There was this tiny little stage at the front, really long bar, some fairly comfortable seats. And a jukebox. It wasn't a DJ's booth. There was simply a jukebox.
Oh, classic.
So kind of like Mary's.
Kind of like Mary's, yeah.
Yeah, the strippers at Mary's just put the money into the jukebox to play their songs.
The strippers put the money in the jukebox to play their songs.
But a classic jukebox, not the modern-day electronic
classic,
one.
Yeah. And the dancers were the dancers that
opened the place.
Just somewhere out of time. Not necessarily the ones that time forgot. But they just didn't belong anywhere else at the other clubs. They were not your traditional strippers. They were not what you would expect to see at any other club. They were weird. They had curves, which is why I went. They had personality. They were just, it was just an odd assortment of people. And they would come down and have a cigarette and talk with you. And it wasn't even a hustle. And mm-hmm. I love that place. It became the Hawthorne Strip. I think they got new management, and they actually improved. You know, it's pretty nice. And then they moved to Powell from Hawthorne to Powell, kept the name Hawthorne Strip, you know, because it's on Powell. And
it's nowhere near. And that place is gone now, too.
No, they're on Powell now, at where Glimmers or Shimmers or whatever it's called used to be. And the last shout out I want to give is a short one, and that's going to be the Tugboat. Tugboat was one of my favorite downtown bars. It's not necessarily, it's hard to call it a dive, although they did get some weird people in there.
It wasn't a dive, but it was dark and dank.
It was dark and dank, and that's why I loved it.
Chernobyl Stout.
God, I miss it so much. We're going to talk about the Tugboat at length later when we bring on a special guest.
So, I just want to say real quick.
All right, say it.
The last time I was at the Tugboat was with Eric Stern. And Eric Stern and I used to go to the Tugboat and play chess together. And when we heard it was closing down, we went there one last time to go one last game of chess and just to go and reminisce about the gloriousness of this beautiful little it wasn't even a micro brew, it was a nano brew.
Yeah.
That's what they called it.
Yeah, they brewed everything in house and they didn't do anything with it, from what I understand.
They just sold it there.
Yeah. And it was really good. And I miss it.
Chernobyl Stout, 10.5-11%. It was so good.
Any last words, guys?
It's a shame when a good bar dies.
It is.
A good bar that goes down is just the loss of character and the loss of innocence of a city that used to be beautiful. I'm talking about you, Portland. Talking about you, Portland.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
Well, we've been drinking this for three segments now for, hours of hours of slaving recording here.
Not the most on-topic session we've ever had.
Not the most on-topic. We've been drifting. We brought Xander back. We got to get back into our
drifting like the desert sands, perhaps, of the desert storm that we have been drinking.
Oh, man. Almost, as you said that, I kind of, my brain immediately shifted into some, like, sepia-toned Fabio commercial for a perfume called, like, Drifting into the Desert Sands. And then something weird looks past you, and then there's suddenly an owl sitting on Fabio's shoulder, and you're like, yes.
And his hair just gets taken up by the wind and just...
And then someone whispers, Desert Storm. And then there's a bottle of perfume, and then it closes out. That was where my brain went when you said that. I've had five of these tonight, guys. Five of these.
You're welcome.
And Xander pours heavy.
So you know, Xander does pour heavy. This is kind of a history that I have with Xander. And eventually, we'll talk about this on a very special episode of Biker's Dice and Bars. Needless to say, I am familiar with Xander's pours. This is weak.
No, I know.
This is weak. We have almost killed a fifth tonight.
Between three of us, yeah.
That's pretty good.
Whatever. That's just an evening for me.
Yep.
Wow.
Really, I'm not that much of a drunk, I promise. So we talked about loot crates. We talked about green lanes. And we talked about dead bars. We talked about a number of things this evening. And honestly, there were three things that kind of pissed me off. We got to have some positive things to talk about
next later. Week. Yeah. We should get on that.
We should add some more positive things to our list of topics.
Well, I know, we could always ask our listeners if they have any topics they'd love to hear us hold forth on. Because, you know, you have three guys here with a fair amount of knowledge on three specific realms and more than a little opinions.
Well, let's ask our listener. Greg, what do you want us to talk about?
Let us know.
Thanks.
Well, I know on one of the lists of things we had to talk about, I think maybe for next time, was what is our favorite video game? I think is what, right?
I have ideas. Oh God.
What is your favorite game? That's a really wide topic right there.
We listed that as questions to ask our guests, and then we never ask them. We should start asking them these questions.
We should,
in fact, at some point, we should just ask each other these questions.
Right.
No, you know, I think that's a good thing.
This is a good jam session, guys. We're looking at our list. I'm like a sheet, at least one sheet into the wind.
Three.
No, three is... I've been three, Xander, and...
Wow, there was no accusation.
Usually involved
in that.
A heavier pour of yours.
I am so sorry.
So it sounds like this is a good point for us to do our closeout and just sit around and talk about the show.
You know what? This is our sixth episode, and yeah. Let's do a quick retrospective here. How do you guys feel about what we've been doing? We're gonna get a little personal here because we're drunk and it's the end of an episode, and you know that's what we do here at Piker's Dice and Bars.
I will just say that this is one of the things that I look forward to the most in my week, is getting down here and talking with you guys about kind of what's on our mind in these three different but yet all somehow still oddly connected realms of things. And I don't know, it's like being here with you guys makes me happy. I really enjoy this. I like the opportunity to go and converse with you because I love hearing your perspectives. And I know, especially this episode, we got a little dusty on a few things, but I do think that that's an important thing to have. You know, if you have a podcast with three monotone, you know, single way thinking people, that's boring as fuck.
Especially if they have a script. Mm.
And I will just say, we don't have a script here.
We have a Google Doc, which has a list of topics, which we might get to.
Yeah, I literally wrote notes down today on my...
That is a guest check.
You know, that's what I wrote down my notes on, and that's all I really had to go off of today. If everything else was kind of improv or... There's like a little bit of an article I read, a piece of, just to get the author's name because I felt that was important. I want to credit people for their work.
And we'll definitely link that article in the notes.
I actually just sent it on Discord right now.
Oh, for everybody on our Discord channel, Greg, thanks for paying attention.
So I don't know, Greg, but to Amanda, Cassie, and several of our other listeners, Leah, I want to say your feedback has been very helpful. I very much appreciated what they've had to say.
We have feedback?
We have feedback.
Ooh.
They want to actually get a good quality headshot of you just to see how glorious the mustache is.
Oh, we can make that happen. We could definitely make that happen.
No. They want a professional shot. Now, you know,
have you guys seen my driver's license, by the way?
Oh, my God. He's pulling out mustache wax from his pocket.
Yes.
Your driver's license could be the cover of a Tom Waits album.
Yes.
Aw, that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said about me.
So, you know, I have a great time with you three. The three of us when
See,
we get
yep,
together.
Yep.
Yep.
How many sheets was that?
I made no claims about that. All I'm going to say is my spanker is firmly tied.
Okay.
Sailing term.
I don't know what that means.
Sailing term.
I would hope so. Greg, if you don't know what that means, please ask us.
When you want to get Jacob's sailing corner, just text the Facebook group and we'll get there. No, we've great. We've covered a lot of good subjects, from the silly to the serious. You know, we're still finding our lane in some ways, but I'm very positive about what's happening. The feedback generally has been good from what I've heard from our listeners, and I look forward to going forward.
But I will just say, too, one of my favorite things about conversing with all of you, every week here has been that we also have so many awesome different perspectives on a lot of things.
Yeah.
We grew up in, I don't think you could probably find a more different areas of the country in which we all grew up in.
This is true.
Yeah.
I mean.
Any of you from Alaska?
That would be the other person
we need. How
about
Hawaii?
Alaska and Hawaii, that's what we
need. Alaska, Hawaii, yeah. And
Puerto Rico?
I mean, maybe the...
Guam?
Where's Poppy from?
Midwest.
Okay, that's it. That was the other part I think we were maybe really missing.
Wait a minute. Northern Minnesota.
You were upper Midwest.
Okay, fair enough. I am lower Canada.
Deep South.
Lower Canada.
You know,
yeah.
Lower Canada. The lowest part of Central, the northernmost part of Southern California.
Yeah.
And Alabama. Like, we have, and we all grew up so differently.
We and could yet, actually even go out of the country and get someone from Florida. We could try that sometime. That's, I don't consider Florida part of the union. It's just owed weird.
Of whatever. all the states you're going to like go, that's not part of the union. You're going with Florida?
Yes.
Hey, I lived in Alabama, which is one state over. Trust me, Florida's weird.
If there's any place that has given this country electoral dysfunction,
not just it is quite. No, it's just one man. Florida man. I salute you.
I actually watched The Florida Project for my birthday. That is a phenomenal film, by the way. If you have not seen that, I highly recommend The Florida Project.
All right, we're drifting into Florida talk here, which is not what I wanted, my intention with that statement.
Your editing on this episode is going to be rough, dude.
It's going to be rough, man. So much of this, I'm probably just going to leave in. I have enjoyed the last six. Well, okay, it's been six official episodes, but we've had character jams. We've had a number of just
fun
hanging out on the mic.
Yeah.
We've got other things coming. We've got on-site bar reviews. We've got interviews stuff. We've got other things in the pipeline.
Don't we have our first live show coming up?
We have a live show coming up, too. It should be fun. I've been having a lot of fun with this, and I'm glad to have both of you here in my studio.
What I think for me, too, is that I didn't know Jacob at all before I came on this podcast. And yet, I have found him to be one of the most interesting people I've met in a long time, and with really awesome cocktail ideas, with many awesome perspectives of things I don't know anything about. And then, you know, NPC over here, again, one of my oldest and dearest friends from the city, who, you know, there was a time we didn't get to see each other all that often, and now I get to see you every other week. That's awesome. That makes me so happy.
Woohoo!
I see this guy every week. Sometimes twice, and it's pretty cool. Thanks, Jacob.
It doesn't
You're
suck.
Welcome. Doesn't suck.
It doesn't suck.
So apparently it's my turn for the bromance section of this episode.
And on that note, I was NPC. And...
Yeah, just close us out there.
All right. You've been listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars, a bi-weekly and occasionally weekly with some bonus stuff podcast here from the Pacific Northwest. I am your host, NPC.
Just Jacob.
And Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And as always, we want to encourage you to keep the rubber side down,
shiny side up,
and always tip your bartender.
Always drink responsibly, and may your dice always roll criticals. Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. But bikes, games, dice, and bars.
I didn't like want to cut you off, but it sounded funny at the time.
No. It was perfect. It was perfect. I'm glad you did.
And that's the end of the show.
Yeah.